Shalom, shalom, wonderful friends. It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for being here today for session 43 of 45. We have session 44 next week with on Martha Nussbaum, followed by session 45 on Kwame Appiah. And then those who choose to stick around, as you'll all be invited to do, we'll start with the 10 biggest the 10 biggest Jewish ideas offered to the world. So anyways, today we are at Peter Singer, who was born in 1946 and is still alive. He actually just announced his retirement a few weeks ago. And let's start with a poll question, because today is going to be provocative. Provocative. It's going to leave us productively uncomfortable. Oh, here we go. Do all lives matter equally? Option one. If our healthcare system can let die someone elderly with only 6 months left to live to save funds to treat children, they should do it. Option two. It doesn't matter if some younger children with more life potential can be saved, and if the elderly person doesn't have much time left, all lives are equal, and everything should be done to save the elderly person if that is what they wish. Okay, friends, option one, saving more young children matters more than prolonging end of life for someone elderly. Option two, everybody's equal quantitatively and qualitatively. One person with 6 months to left is infinitely valuable just as much as 10 children. Okay, 17% say we should take a more utilitarian approach. And if we can save more people and more younger people, then that matters more than prolonging end of life. 83% say, can't play God, can't decide which life matters more, can't make those decisions. And so even though it may feel wasteful, we should do all to prolong life because every life matters. Okay, very interesting. So we will get into that debate and many others today. And as I said, it is provocative. It's going to get a little fiery in here, although I see our friend Aglaia is not here. So so maybe only so fiery. We've got our more tame group. Okay, great. But maybe you'll bring the fire in her place because group dynamics shift when someone's here and somebody's not here. We value everybody and their role. Okay. Are human lives worth more than animal lives? Someone who spends $5,000 on a vacation, morally guilty for not using that money to save someone's life? Should we rethink our entire system of living in order to maximize the well-being of all living creatures? Born to a Jewish family in Australia, Peter Singer is one of the great living philosophers. He's currently a professor of bioethics at Princeton, although, as I said, announced his retirement. And in addition to being distinguished within the world of academia, he's also well known as a public intellectual. He's probably top five kind of well-known public philosophers. Now, that doesn't mean you're the best philosopher. It just means that you've decided to make your ideas very relatable. And that's part of your ideology, is you want people, the common person, to think about your ideas rather than just kind of academics. One reason for this is that he has devoted significant energy towards writing for a popular audience, not just an academic one, but also his work deals with issues of great concern to all of our lives and our basic moral decisions. Singer is a fervent utilitarian. Though he's evolved in the nuances of his utilitarianism, he espouses. Early in his career, Singer was a preference utilitarian, which held that, quote, actions are right if they maximize the satisfaction of preferences or desires, no matter what the preferences may be for, right? So we don't judge what somebody wants. Yes, thank you, Sarah, I agree. Without acknowledging what somebody wants, the goal is to minimize pain and maximize pleasure. That is how we think of moral decisions. If I can make a choice that's going to reduce suffering for five people or increase pleasure for one, I choose to decrease suffering for five, and so forth. It doesn't matter what the nature of it is. We're not judging, you know, how noble those pleasures are in this preference utilitarianism, or whether there's any value to the pain at all. We just think that people should feel good. However, this philosophy is controversial because people can have preferences of many different kinds, including things many would consider immoral. If harming another would give one greater pleasure than the pain caused, under preference utilitarianism, this would be allowed. Singer later changed his view to hedonistic utilitarianism, which argues that the right action is the one that produces or is most likely to produce the greatest net happiness for all concerned, right? So you might say, well, there's five guys and they really want to bully this other guy. Shouldn't we give preference to the five bullies? Because yeah, the one being bullied is suffering a little bit, but those five bullies are getting a lot of pleasure out of that. Those five bullies feel really good, you know? And, or you might say, well, Russia has the right to do whatever they want to Ukrainians, because Russia has a much larger population than Ukrainians, and they're all going to benefit from this. So who cares what's principally right or wrong, right? At the end of the day, like, more Russians are going to benefit than Ukrainians who are going to suffer. So it gets a little complicated. This approach helped make Singer a leading philosophical proponent of animal rights. In his 1975 book, Animal Liberation, which was kind of like the Bible of early animal rights movement, he made the first strong philosophical case for animal rights. He argued that in maximizing the greatest net happiness, we must also take into consideration the suffering of animals. Animal rights, we see, are a natural consequence of utilitarianism. If we truly want to minimize suffering on a mass level, and not just for human beings, the cruelty that so many animals endure must absolutely be taken into account. Now, here it's worth mentioning that Singer does not believe in human dignity, which is to say that humans matter for their, you know, in their own right. What matters for humans is their pain and pleasure. And that's why humans are no different than animals for Singer, by and large, because if animals can suffer and humans can suffer, we don't care about human rights more than animal rights from some rights perspective. We don't care about humans more than animals from some dignity perspective. The cat suffers, the woman suffers, and those suffering have equal moral weight, because any being who's suffering matters, according to Singer. It should be to no one's surprise that Jewish texts can be found to support part of the view he mentions. However, the Jewish tradition has tended to focus on defending animal welfare rather than promoting a narrower understanding of animal rights, right? The animal doesn't have a right, doesn't have a legal claim. Rather, we as humans care about their welfare. This is to say that while the Torah doesn't have a clear notion of animal liberation, right, that would be anachronistic for sure, it provides clear injunctions to reduce the suffering of animals that are put to human use. For example, we read in the book of Deuteronomy, "You shall not muzzle an ox while it is threshing." The reason for this is that if an animal is being made to work for you, it must also be able to eat. Don't block the animal that you're working from eating. That would be an unfair form of suffering for the animal. While human beings have a right to use animals, there is still a dignity to them, one might argue, that must be respected. While there is a distinction between animal welfare and human welfare, they exist on the same level as possessing the dignity of being living creatures that God intentionally created with compassion, even if they differ in that only humans are created in the image of God. But we see that even though animals don't have the right to not be eaten, there's still a dignity to them that must be respected. The Torah immediately goes on to explain that just as animal blood demands our decency, one cannot shed human blood. To be sure, one cannot kill a human because of their dignity as being created in the image of God, not because of any relationship to animal blood, but the blood connection is nonetheless still there. While there's a distinction between animal welfare and human welfare, they exist on the same continuum as possessing the dignity being living creatures. And so there's a Torah concern for animals. But Singer takes it further. In an email exchange I had with him, Singer once told me that not only does he not believe in human dignity being higher than the dignity of animals, he doesn't believe in human dignity at all. To state what's probably obvious, Singer doesn't believe in God in any way. So why should he think human beings are created in the image of God, right? Biblically, we might say human rights are very high because humans have infinite value. Why? Well, not just because we wish humans have infinite value, but because we're created in the image of God, whatever that means. And because of that, human concerns matter more than animal concerns. But if you say, I don't believe in God in any way, I'm only concerned with suffering, there's no distinction between a sheep and an 80-year-old woman. For atheists, the burden is on them to argue why human life is worth more than animal life. His concern is not with the isolated moral concern of dignity, but just about pain and pleasure at large. So for Singer, human suffering is not more important than animal suffering. Or as he put it decades ago in Animal Liberation, all the arguments to prove man's superiority cannot shatter this hard fact. In suffering, the animals are our equals. In Judaism, this is not upheld as its humanity, specifically that bears the image of God and the higher levels of the soul. Human life, we see from the Torah, must take precedence over animal life. Although we should be compassionate to animals and treat their suffering as having enormous ethical weight and implications for how we live, in the Jewish tradition, we cannot conflate the dignity of humans with our need to reduce suffering for animals. These conflicting views between the Torah and Singer's philosophy can make us ask the question, does one human matter more than two animals? What about 10 million animals? How many animals might we be willing to kill to save one human? Of course, this emerges in conversations around animal testing, right? Now, some of us might more easily say, well, maybe not for cosmetics, right? Maybe we shouldn't torture animal for cosmetics, but what about for life-saving medical cures? Should we be willing to kill five monkeys, five chimpanzees, rather than test it on a human? What if it's 100 chimpanzees? What if it's 1,000? What if it's 1,000,000? What about rats? Is it different if we talk about rats than chimps? should we be, are we willing to kill a million rats rather than do animal test, drug testing on a human? In my engagement with Singer's thought, I not only see human, see animal rights in a different light, but also find that his views on how we treat the elderly to be divergent from mainstream Jewish values. Because of his rigid insistence on a rational utilitarianism, Singer believes that we as a society are spending too much money on keeping people alive at the end of life, when it's clear that the quality of life declines so precipitously. Rather than prolong the life of the elderly, Singer claims the ethical thing to do would be to allocate more resources towards saving more young people. Famously, when Singer's mother was near the end of life, his family spent a large amount of money to keep her alive. To his credit, Singer acknowledged that when it was the case of his family, his ethics demanded a cold utilitarianism that had been too difficult to uphold. You know, I forgot the cost of the drug. I think it was something like $90,000. They said, Singer, your mom's going to live for 6 more months for a $90,000 drug. Now, according to Singer's philosophy, that's insane, right? According to Singer's philosophy, I can donate $90,000. My mother had a good long life, and I can go save countless, countless children through an intervention. But Singer chose the medicine for his mother against his own philosophy. And when he was pressed, why did you do that? You spent this whole career teaching that saving more people matters more than extending, you know, minimal amount of life for someone else. He said, yeah, but it's my mother, right? And so, in fact, do philosophies have to work to have moral weight, right? Or if in the end of the day, we're going to say, hey, it's my mother, or come on, can't I buy a cup of coffee, or can't I go on vacation, right? Is it just too much? In another area in Singer's thought, I found to be similarly problematic, he makes clear that he does not place a premium on those who have special needs, right? The disabilities community is probably the most loudly opposed to Singer. He believes that society should not devote large amounts of resources to accommodate a small group of people. This is another instance of a clash between Singer's view that we must maximize pleasure and reduce suffering, and a potential Jewish belief that all people are infinitely precious. Now, just to spell this out a little bit, like, he's like, why would our society spend like millions of dollars building ramps and building elevators so that a handful of people can occasionally in a wheelchair use them? He's like, yeah, I feel bad for the person in a wheelchair, but like millions of dollars restructuring all of our society's buildings to benefit these handful of people in each institution, right? Those millions could be used to save so many other lives. Now, if you're a disabilities rights activist, that's incredibly offensive, right? That you don't acknowledge the rights of people with disabilities and prioritize their needs. But from a utilitarian who wants every dollar to maximize pleasure and reduce suffering, says, well, that's really misspent, right? For Singer, rights are simply unimportant. What matters is the well-being of most people. Judaism, one might argue, would disagree. The Jewish tradition values the dignity of every individual, not the sum total of pleasure experienced by the masses. As the rabbis say, why was Adam, the first human being, created alone? To teach you that one who destroys a soul, the Torah treats it as if one has destroyed an entire world. And conversely, one who saves a soul, the Torah treats it as if they've saved an entire world, right? You simply can't say that five people matter more than one person, right? One person, it has infinite value. It's also important to know that Singer has long been a driving force in the movement for effective altruism, if you've heard of that movement. In 2022, Gideon Lewis Krauss explained in The New Yorker that effective altruism takes as its premise that people ought to do good in the most clear-sighted, ambitious, and unsentimental way possible. Among other back-of-the-envelope estimates, effective altruists believe that a life in the developing world can be saved for about $4,000. Now, that's complicated. There's different ways to measure that, and depends who you're talking about and what type of intervention we're talking about. We'll discuss this in more detail when we look later into William McCaskill. But it is notable here the way that Singer challenges us to think about philanthropy differently. Singer makes the argument that it's not possible to ethically justify living with luxuries. If you choose to spend your money on unnecessary expenses, you are in effect saying, I know I can save a life with this money, but instead I choose this luxury. Singer's utilitarianism leads him to believe that without even intending to harm another, one can be complicit in suffering and death. In his book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty, Singer even invokes the Jewish tradition to demonstrate that giving one's money to reduce poverty is not just a good deed, it's a moral obligation. He writes, the Hebrew word for charity, tzedakah, simply means justice. And as this suggests, for Jews, giving to the poor is no optional extra, but an essential part of living a just life. In the Talmud, a record of discussions of Jewish law and ethics by ancient rabbis, it said that charity is equal in importance to all the other commandments combined, and that Jews should give at least 10% of their income as tzedakah. Now, just as a reminder, Singer is not religious. Singer is not deeply connected to the Jewish community. He's certainly not a Jewish educator. This is relatively random that he's bringing this point, but it's but he's bringing this point to demonstrate part of his idea around effective altruism. In general, as Jews, we might agree with effective altruism. We do need to be more careful about directing our tzedakah to save lives rather than just pouring large sums of money into passion projects and luxuries. We should be seriously challenged by the levels of luxury we live with. To be sure, we understand as Jews that life is a gift to be celebrated and enjoyed. But that comes with the responsibility of also thinking critically of how we allocate our time and resources toward a higher moral calling. So friends, to conclude here, the life we are given is such a precious thing. And Singer understands that it's incumbent upon each of us not to waste it, to think carefully about how we can best use the opportunities we have and to act in a way that is morally reputable, even if the paths he thinks we should take are often different from the ones I'd endorse. I find Singer asks the questions we must engage with in order to live ethical lives. Okay, friends, two last things before I open up the conversation. One is, let me give an example of how he would flip a current moral debate on its head. Let's take abortion. If I am pro-life, I might say something like, I believe God gave a soul to the fetus, and that is a life, and I may not kill that life, even if a mother is not interested in giving birth to that life, because that life is a life, and there is a right to that life. If I'm pro-choice, I might say something like, hey men, hands off women's bodies and hands off women's rights. Women have the right to make their own choice. And after all, I don't think it's a life anyways. A living woman's choice should matter more than a potential life. Singer's not interested in either of those arguments. He's not interested in rights, as we said. He's not interested in women's rights, and he's not interested in fetus rights, nor is he interested in the dignity of the life of the fetus or the dignity of the life of the mother. He's interested in suffering. And so what he would want to know empirically is, at what point can that fetus suffer? Because if you kill a suffering entity, it will suffer. And we need to measure the suffering of that fetus versus the suffering of that mother. And the potential suffering of that life, if it comes to be alive and it's born into poverty or suffering, whatever the case is. So it's a way of reframing the debates we kind of hear over and over, Now, just so you can hear, singer, one of the pleasures of people who are living, I can't remember if we played my conversation with Noam Chomsky or not, if we just gave you the link. But anyways, you can hear me talking with Chomsky. And in the next two, in our next two sessions, you'll hear me talking with Martha Nussbaum. You'll hear me talking with Kwame Appiah. And now let's hear a minute of me talking with Peter Singer. And let me give a framing before we jump into the video. So one of the controversial ideas Singer has, but I think it's productively controversial, is that he thinks that we used to, sorry, let me take a step back. If someone is drowning in a lake while I'm walking down the road, I'm a jerk. I'm a jerk. If I'm like, hey, I don't want to jump in the water to save this person because I'm wearing my fancy shoes today. Like, I don't care if you're wearing fancy shoes. You got to save the life of the person drowning in the lake. So he says, well, today in an internet age, we know the person drowning in the lake is happening on the other side of the world. We don't need to see them right in front of us. So we should be willing to get our shoes wet, ruin our $50 shoes or $100 shoes to save that life. Right. So two, if someone is pulling at my feet when I'm buying a cup of coffee for $3, saying that they need $3 to live, I'm a jerk if I buy a $3 cup of coffee when that person needs the $3 to live. Right. But he says, why should we pretend the person isn't alive asking for that if they're not at our feet? That person on the other side of the world who needs that malaria net for $3, right? If I buy that cup of coffee, I'm engaging in an act of murder because I chose the luxury of my coffee over the $3 to the malaria net to save that person. So he thinks we should curb those luxuries. I know we've touched on this issue before, but just to bring it home, because this is Singer, we should curb those luxuries in the interest of saving life, which matters much more, Singer wants to argue. So too, he gets to the point of donating a kidney. If I have an extra kidney in my body and I know someone will die, I would be committing murder by keeping my extra kidney for no other reason, just to have a backup kidney when I know somebody could live if I donated it. So here, it's a whole 11-minute, 30-second, 36-second interview. But here I kind of ask him about that a little more, because he kind of implied too that, geez, is one a murderer if they don't donate a kidney? And here, let's see how he kind of softens his response to my question.
Do you believe one's second kidney could be viewed as a luxury? And how does your argument about the moral problem with buying coffee as opposed to donating for a malaria net, vis-a-vis being a luxury versus saving a life, apply here? Is an organ fundamentally different from one's money, or is it another form of luxury that is comparable?
Well, there's something slightly funny about saying that something that you're born with and that everybody else has is a luxury. I suppose, you could say, well, why did we evolve to have two kidneys? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe there's something about symmetry, if you like, the various things that we have two of, and that somehow was a pattern by which we and many other animals, of course, evolved. And you couldn't have called it a luxury until we had the ability to remove one and save someone's life or greatly benefit somebody from it. And that's only very recently. But I suppose what you could say is that the development of this technology, medical technology for transplanting a kidney, has made it something that it's optional and that we don't really need. And yes, in that strict sense of the term, it's a luxury. Now you asked, how does it compare with the luxuries of going out and buying a coffee or buying bottled water when the water that comes out of your tap is safe to drink? Those things are luxuries too. The answer to that is it's a lot easier to not buy the bottled water, or, unless you're a real coffee addict, to pass up the coffee or to make the coffee at home where you save a couple of dollars by doing that. That's a lot easier for most people than the thought of going in a hospital, having a kidney removed, a few days off work. And people do worry about the idea that something may go wrong. And although, as I said, the chances are very small, it's possible. So that's the difference, that one of them is really very easy to do, and there's, in a way, no excuse for not doing it. The other one, I can be more you know, empathize with people who feel that this is a much bigger deal.
Right. So,
okay, so you get a little taste of his thinking. And one of the things that I think is interesting there is, you know, as you might recall from your philosophy 101 class in college, philosophers are often kind of up in the sky, right? They're quoting theories and you don't really understand what they're talking about. But Singer, even though he's at Princeton and Australia University, I forgot, the Melbourne University, I forgot what it's called. You know, I mean, top Ivy League professor, he's made a career of talking like that in a way that anybody can access what he's talking about. Very practical, very accessible. And that's what he thinks is the value of moral philosophy. The value of moral philosophy is not just some elitist enterprise of you know, kind of debating footnotes, but actually it's about changing the world. It's about persuading people to do what's right. And so anyways, let me pause here. And we've thrown a bunch out here, and I'd love to hear people's thoughts and questions on anything we've discussed. Yes, hi, Steve.
Hi. Number one in this, this is kind of a personal thing. When you introduced Singer, you said he's 76 and he's still alive. And I thought, oh my God, I'm 4 years older. Should I be worried about something? Number two, and you mentioned this earlier, and it's not in direct reference to Singer. You said image of God, whatever that means. And I have no idea. I stumble over this all the time. I can propose that the image of God is the desire to create things, ideas, the desire to connect with other people, and the desire to express compassion. That to me is as close to the image of God as, and I'm not a God, personal God person, but that's as close to it as I can come. And I'll reserve my last comment for later.
Okay, very cool. Yeah, so those three C's are very interesting. The human capacity for creating, for connecting, and for being compassionate. And I love that. And there's been great debates over the millennia as to what about the human being is godly, whether one thought it was our capacity for reason, our capacity for speech, our capacity for empathy, whether it's our souls, right, that we have a spiritual capacity, whether it is freedom, that God is infinitely free and humans are free, whether it is actually a physical dimension, as is the literal read of the text. But most people don't want to go that route because they'll deny God's physicality or corporeality. But that's a fascinating debate. And I think your three contributions there are so interesting. The ability to create. Interesting enough, the very first mitzvah given in the Torah is peru urvu, which is to be fruitful and multiply, which in a literal sense means reproduction. But in a non-literal sense, it means be creative, right? Create in the world. And the very first thing God does is create. The very first line, Bereshit bara Elohim et shamayim et haaretz, God creates the heaven and earth. And so that notion of being creative and then connecting, that God creates a world, presumably in order to have a connection to it. Again, you know, if that the personal theology question gets in there, but what might make us godly is our ability to connect. And then lastly, compassion. And that's a great debate also. Are humans fundamentally compassionate, or is that something that has to be cultivated? If we think back to Rousseau and some of our other early modern thinkers, the whole debate around the of the role of education in life. Is the role of education that people are innately compassionate and we need to harness that? Or is it that humans are a blank slate and we need to kind of, develop a capacity that's not there at all? So the same question with the social setting. Is the social setting developing our empathy and our capacity for compassion? Or is the social setting actually destroying it and kids need to be educated in isolation? So anyways, the question of image of God is very interesting. And again, Singer rejects that, not only because he rejects God, but also rejects dignity. But it is a fascinating question in terms of how much humans matter, how much we matter at all. Thanks, Stephen. Hopefully we'll circle back to your next question. Hi, Sarah.
Gosh, there's so much to talk about. As I had said long ago, I'm really enjoying The Most Good You Can Do by Peter Singer. And it's helped me look more at my altruism and how I use my resources. So much of what you said was so interesting, especially when we talk about animals versus humans. And, you know, human dignity means we can do whatever we want. But I thought, well, but in the Hasidic tradition, isn't everything imbued with this godliness so that animals, much less trees and rocks and everything else, has dignity, has godliness within? And so I don't see the debate there. Even if Singer doesn't believe in God, it becomes an egalitarian thing. And, you know, certainly a Buddhist perspective would be, you know, may none of us suffer, may all beings be happy and lack suffering. When we get to, I mean, certainly from my standpoint as a physician, I always struggled with family members who, despite the patient having signed a DNR, family would fight, would go to court, would do everything to override that because we have to keep mom alive or we need to keep dad alive. And in spite of that parent's wishes, which, you know, put somebody, I had a cardiologist who kept a patient in the ICU for over a year and kept forcing us to resuscitate him until, you know, like after a year and a half, he finally died. But I think it was about our individual need to succeed, to be the hero, to do something more than what the condition really leads us to. Another part was the disabilities question and how much money we spend. And what's fascinating to me about that is that while we do it for the disability community, everyone actually gains from that. So whether changing the ramps on sidewalks is a good thing for wheelchairs, but it's also great for mom when she's got the stroller. And it makes life so much easier for people to have an island in the middle, because not only as we get older, it's hard to cross these massive roadways, but for a mother with four or five kids in hand, oh my gosh, there are so many things we've done when mom is trying to take the stroller and everybody else up the elevator. Thank goodness for elevators. How else is she going to get to the offices she needs to get to with those children? It's a struggle. So I don't know that we can judge the utilitarian piece of how we treat one part of the community as opposed to another. When I look at digital technology and how, you know, yes, the blind have celebrated it, the hearing impaired, it's great for them, but it's great for all of us to be able to do things that we couldn't do before because it's made our lives just a little bit better. We're suffering less. The only other thing I wanted to bring up as you were talking about the abortion question, it's like, but if you're in Alabama, if you happen to have a fertilized zygote, my goodness, there we go. That fertilized ovum suddenly is a human. What? But I won't even get into that debate.
Okay.
Although Maybe if Aglaia was here, we could do that. So that's enough from me. Thanks.
Okay, very cool. Okay, so much to talk about there, but I'll just be brief. Yeah, on your point of inclusivity, I think it's really interesting, actually, that it's too narrow to only count those who appear to be the most direct, obvious recipients of inclusivity practices, and that inclusivity actually benefits us all in ways we may not be able to predict. And that's a very interesting point. On the end of life points, I think those are also fascinating, and they're very far reaching. Obviously, in cases like, how many of us want to be intubated long term? How many of us are going to make sure to give instructions that we don't want to be intubated in a bed, you know, for months or years, or comatose? That we should stop treatments if we're comatose or intubated. Whatever, these are difficult issues. But then there's some of the more difficult ones of like, when does a medical provider or clergy or family member stop pushing someone on treatments when they're just so exhausted? Someone is frail, it's their seventh round of chemo or the like, you know, and they're just suffering through it. At what point do we say, hey, you're strong, you got this? And at what point do we say, I want you to know I support you if you choose to stop these treatments? And a whole bunch of positions in between those. And so, yeah, those are really interesting questions. And unfortunately, a lot of tensions come out between family members when those kind of discussions happen, even relationships that don't predict it, that tension to emerge. And the best way a parent can ensure to reduce those tensions is by giving very direct instructions to kids so that the kids aren't guessing about, what about this case? What would they want in this case? What would they want in that case, right? And then now they're fighting about what they think the parent would want, as opposed to saying, the parent was very clear, right? It's not on us, we're just doing what they want, right? Okay, now to your last point, and then we'll move on, but around animals in the Kabbalistic tradition. I think that's so interesting. And there's a lot to say about that. You know, in rationalistic religion, it's all about differences. How is the Jew different than the Gentile? How is the man different than the woman? How is the elderly different than the baby? Everything is cut up into little slices of analysis. Everything is uniquely different and ought to be explored and contrasted, this and that. In mysticism, as opposed to rationalism, there's oneness. Yes, there's difference, but the difference is somewhat of an illusion within the unity of all life and all being. And so you're going to find writings of Kabbalists, of Jewish mystics, such as letting themselves get bitten by bugs rather than kill the mosquito or kill the bug, because all of life is interconnected. Or something like Rav Kook, who said he would never cut a branch off a tree or pick a flower, because why would I end that life? Now, those are not moral concerns of suffering, like a Singer debate, as opposed to a kind of a theology of interconnectivity, a theology of the oneness of life that I am simply a part of, and that I have a reverence for the sparks of divinity within everything. So, but yeah, there is an interesting Kabbalistic intersection with Singer, and you know, when you get to the point of thinking of each being, but the orientation is so different in terms of how they get there. Okay, anyways, fascinating point, Sarah, and I'm sure you had 10 more you could have raised as well. So thank you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. So I put in the chat, and I wasn't being sarcastic, because he's lost me on so many levels. You know, he's not my guy. But you know, when he spent the $90,000 for his mother's medicine, and then says, why are we building ramps for, people in wheelchairs? You know, what would he have done if his mother was in a wheelchair? I mean, that's the whole thing. If he changed his mind like that, you know, so the people's, you know, is his human feelings and failings come into play right then and there too. And the other thing I was going to say, if he doesn't have someone who has a disability, it's very hard to judge you know, to some, it's hard to be in someone else's shoes and say what someone else should do in a situation like that. I also just visited my almost 98-year-old dad, and he is quite clear on his wishes as far as, you know, burial or cremation in this point, at this point. And he, you know, it's not something that I believe in, but it's what he wants, you know, and I believe in respecting his wishes since he's made it quite clear. On the other hand, with the DNR things, I don't know. I don't even know if he has one, but I was wondering just in a general sense, and with Singer and suffering, that what about the suffering of the surviving family too? So it might not only be, you know, if you say, if the suffering of the patient is, you know, such that you would say, okay, you know, that we should be letting that person go, but the suffering of the family for missing that person or the loss, you know, that has to come into play somewhat too. It's not on the same level, but it's suffering nonetheless. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Great. That's a fascinating last point. And I take your, and I hear your critiques as well. Very interesting. And I don't want to say much because I want to bring more voices in the room, but I appreciate the ideas you're sharing here. And I think that, to Singer's credit, I think he would say that like theories should be created outside of the realm of the emotionally overwhelming moments. He'd say, yeah, like I'm glad when I'm buying this medicine for my mom that I'm not the one at that moment developing the theory, because I think what I'm doing is kind of not justifiable, even though it's what I want to do. And, but rather when we're removed from that situation, we can give theories that make more sense. But again, I think that's also a problem because lives are real and we have to account for that as well. Now, one of the interesting extensions of utilitarianism in the next generation comes from a guy named McCaskill. McCaskill's a young Scottish philosopher, and he's famous for an idea called long-termism. Long-termism means that we are more concerned with the larger number of potential lives to come than we are with the smaller number of current lives that exist. Now bring in climate change. You'd say, how can you justify spending your philanthropy to combat climate change when currently there's living people who need your help? Right? And that would be a fair moral position, that we care more about living people than non-living people, right? And so you should, but McCaskill says, if you add up all the number of people that are going to exist in the future against the people who live currently, that number is astronomically larger, and your effective altruism, your philanthropy would go much further to invest in the sustainability of the world to impact many more people than the currently living. So that's where utilitarianism gets extended into long-termism, that we care more about non-existing lives that are greater in number than the current lives that are existing. And that has some interesting twists and turns if you look at that as well. So anyways, let me pause there for anyone else who wants to hop in. Yeah, hi, Gary.
Hi, I think just to expand on Cheryl and Sarah's comments, yeah. I think utilitarianism seems to win if you control strictly the definition of who benefits. So that if there's 1,000 handicapped and 1,000,000 non-handicapped, it's obviously it's the million. But if you start to add in the mother who has to wheel the baby up and all the stress of the family worrying about grandma, and the rest, then it starts to get even more balanced. And I think another dimension for me is what it does to all of us who see the ramp. Meaning just looking at it, go, we live in a society that devotes resources to care for the less fortunate. I think improves the quality of every single person who walks by that shopping center and sees the ramp. So the number is now 1 equals 1, because if there's 1,000,000 people who are going to walk by, they're each have the potential to benefit. They may not benefit, but they have that capacity. So that's my expansion on Sarah Sherrill expansion of Singer's utilitarianism.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. And I think there's also a case to say sometimes you do what's right, even if it's right based on a duty, even if it doesn't fit into that cost-benefit analysis. And I think there's many cases we can all think of like that. But let me give another case where I think consequentialism, another term for utilitarianism, would fall short. Think about just warfare. One might say, well, think about the arguments of proportionality that exist today. One might say, well, you can only kill as many of the enemy as they've killed of you, right? Or the like, or a similar type of argument that only looks at the numbers, right? And like, how can you justify killing X number of people when, you know, they only killed Y number of your people, right? It doesn't make any sense. And then you just bring that to Nazi Germany and you realize how quickly such an argument falls flat. Be like, the US Army is going to enter to defeat the Nazis. And in fact, you could only morally justify killing as many Nazi soldiers as US soldiers they killed, right? Or what if you said the response to the Japan is only going to be to kill as many people as died in Pearl Harbor, right? There's no moral justification to kill any more, right? So it gets really complicated when you think about what's just in warfare, as opposed to just kind of the calculation of numbers. And then you get into the absurd of trying to calculate the future. Well, how many people will we benefit in the future if we defeat the Nazis, right? If the Nazis take over the world, I guess that's, you know, everyone's going to kind of lose out on that, right? On the other hand, if we kill, 50,000 Nazi soldiers and 100,000 civilians are going to die in that process too, right? And that's really terrible that German civilians are going to die. But defeating Nazi Germany is just what's right for the world, right? So that gets complicated too. Okay, so Eddie, I see you're going to hop in here.
Yeah, thank you, Rabbi. I wanted to add another component to what's the conversation already going around on the curve cut effect that has benefited so many communities. I also think that this is a component that supports shining a light on people who are often unseen, and elevating folks who society deems not, like, you know, like these aren't the highlights of community. And I think how when we focus on supporting smaller groups of people, folks that are often in the feel like they're in the shadows get uplifted. And to me, what comes to an example is oftentimes a lot of people who were left-handed were forced to be right-handed. But then when regulation stopped on people being left-handed, more communities who were left-handed started coming out, started being uplifted, has started being seen. Same with other communities who benefit from having a disability now being able to go into the crosswalk. We noticed that then it led up to people hearing chimes when going through a crosswalk who were not able to have, who are visually impaired. So I think that this also like brings in a component of illuminating a light to communities who often aren't seen, and creating a beacon of hope for folks to know that, like, in my opinion, this is how progress works. And when we think about shining a light to those who are in the shadows.
Yeah, great. You know, it's funny. I was just falling asleep last night telling my 5-year-old and 7-year-old all the details of the story of Rosa Parks and the 381 days of the bus boycott and the like. And but, you know, to pick up on Eddie's remark here, like, imagine if you're in a village and only boys can go to school. And one girl shows up and be like, please, can I come? I really want to learn, too. Say, well, you're only one girl. You're only one girl, and we can't accommodate that. But right, as soon as you change the policy for that one girl, a whole bunch of girls are like, wait a minute, I can come too. I want to come too. So right, they're in the dark. They're not in the line. But once the policy has been changed, or you make it more inclusive, a whole bunch of people who aren't seen are now a part of that benefit system as well. And I think that's a really important point. because many people are not the type who are going to line up or protest or make a request. But when the policy becomes more inclusive, that what that changes, or you know, and you can, we can extend this on so many other levels as well. So thank you for that. Friends, I look forward to seeing you for session 44 next week with Martha Nussbaum, and then for session 45 with Kwame Appiah. And I wish everyone a beautiful day. Sorry for moving from Tuesday to Wednesday. I had to be at a conference yesterday. Have a wonderful day. See you soon. Thanks so much for your insights.